Mr. James Reel, too.
Well, Wingate made no attempt to use them in the way they were accustomed to be used. I don't know if you know the background of his tactics in going into Burma. We had to cross the river without being spotted by the Japanese or giving them any ideas to what we were up to. The first objective being to reach the railway, the Rangoon-Michinar Railway, and blow that up. So he divided the force into two groups. There was one group, which was we call the Northern Group, which had Wingate himself at his headquarters, and it had two Gurkha columns, three column, my column, four column, and it had three British columns, that's right, five, which is Ferguson's column, seven, Jilks, and eight was Major Scott, Scotty Scott's column. And then the other group consisted of just two Gurkha companies. That was numbers one and two columns, commanded by the group commander of that group, who was in fact Colonel Alexander, who was the CO of the 3rd-2nd Gurkha Rifles. And the scheme was that number two, the South Group, under Alexander, would be the decoy, would cross the Irrawaddy, the Chinwin, openly, together with some tactical movements by other regiments not concerned in the actual expedition, to try and attract the attention of the Japs, while we went further north and crossed Tonne. And the idea being that the Japs would then think that we're coming, that this was the main move, and that we were feinting at Tonne. Well, it happened, it worked, because, in fact, the Japs at that time were not really so well established on the Chinwin anyway. But the thing was that once that he used this column, this group, number two group, really as a decoy, and I think that this is where he misunderstood, I think, the Gurkha battalion. As far as he was concerned, they were the decoy. And my feeling is, and it's the same with all the second, that he didn't really care two hoots what happened to them afterwards. His main objective was to get to the railway with the other, his group, and blow it up. So, and as you say, we were talking about his attitude to Gurkhas. But I will say this, he learned his lesson, because for the second expedition he asked for Gurkhas specifically. And they did very well. But he did destroy the 3rd-2nd Gurkhas, because when they came back they had to be completely rebuilt.
Now, I interrupted your narrative with you going into Burma. Can you take up the story from there, please?
Well, as I was saying, they had to... he had the two groups for his tactics. And my column being three column, we were in the Northern Group, which was the main group going in at Tonhe to blow up the railway. So we marched, I think it'd probably be two or three nights, I suppose, we marched through the jungle, down to the river, and across the river, Chinwin. And we were going to cross by columns. And I remember I told you that earlier that there were about 350 men and about 80 mules and about 20 horses and a lot of bullocks to get across this river, which was about 400 yards wide. And the point was that none of the Gurkhas could swim, which is a grave mistake Wingate made. He made... And he admitted afterwards, in action, his report, that he made no real attempt, serious attempt, to teach the Gurkhas how to swim beforehand. And in fact, a lot of the British troops couldn't swim. And yet we were going across the grain of the country, so we had to cross the rivers the whole way. Which meant, of course, that it was the officers, the British officers, and the commandos, who had to get the mules and horses across the column, while the Gurkhas went quite calmly in the boats across the river. Well, we had quite a job getting those horses and mules across, but we were all day at it, and eventually we got them across. And then we went on to what was going to be the first airdropping, where, as the columns all crossed in the northern group, we were going to have this joint airdropping, because, of course, as you know, the idea was that there were no communications. Our only link would be by air, and we would have air supplies dropped to us. So, do you want me telling you about the supply
Please.
Drops? Well, I had a first-hand view of this because I went with a platoon to look after to guard Bobby Thompson, who was the RAF liaison officer in our column and who was organizing this particular brigade drop. He later became Sir Robert Thompson of Malay fame. And the system of supplying was that back in Agartala, near Dhaka, India, would be brigade rear headquarters and also a squadron of, I think, the Dakotas, and were there some Hudsons as well, I think, and all the supplies would be there. And then, of course, when the column wanted supplies, they would radio in with their requests, and then they would give a map reference and so on as to where the drop would take place. And then at night, they'd light the fires, and the plane would come over, and then we'd signal. And then they would come over in turn and drop the supplies, with parachute for the breakable stuff, and the free drops for things like mule fodder and so on, or even uniforms and things, would just come down and free drop without parachutes. And the idea was that everybody thought it was quite new, you see, nobody had done this before, that you had to have a nice open paddy field. Later on, of course, we discovered, mainly accidents on, you could actually have them anywhere, even in thick jungle. So that was the first supply drop. And the first thing we discovered, of course, was that the rations were quite pitiful, quite inadequate. they were supposed to be, one day's ration consisted of some shakapura biscuits and some dates and raisins and so on, and a bit of tea and things like that. And there was no sort of meat or anything like that. Occasionally they used to drop corned beef, I believe, but the Gurkhas, of course, not eating beef, that was no use to them. But the point was that everyone thought perhaps one day's ration would go one day. But eventually we soon discovered, in fact, that because of once we got into Burma and the difficulties of getting airdrops when you wanted them, because of Japanese in the locality perhaps, one day's ration often had to go 3 or 4 days. So, which was very difficult indeed. So, and you had to try and supplement it with rice and stuff from a village if you could. But when you've got 350 people, to get sufficient rice and stuff from the village is not very easy. And, and when you're marching something like an average of 10 miles a day through jungle and fighting and everything else for several weeks into months, you can just imagine that it had a very bad effect on morale in general. And I would say that probably the British troops felt it more than the Gurkha troops, mainly because, of course, in Nepal, being a very poor country, I mean, these days, 60% of the Nepalese are on a breadline, In those days, it must have been even more, so they're probably used to not eating quite so much. So they probably didn't feel it quite so much as the British troops, but they still felt it. And the other point was, which of course was, as I was saying, the Gurkha battalion is like a family, and they get their rations are given to them, and they're told, you know, here you are, this is your rations. But on this sort of expedition, everybody carried their own ration. Because when you were given 7 days' rations in your pack, and with all your stuff, it weighed an incredible 65 pounds. I still don't know to this day how the hell I carried it. And, of course, the lighter your pack got, of course, the more worried you got. However, the point was each Gurkha was responsible for his own food. And at first, it was very difficult to be able to control them, you see. Because every now and then they'd have a bite. And of course, before you knew where it was, they had nothing left. And it was a very tricky problem to control them in that way. They learnt, of course, from the hard way eventually, but at first it was a ticklish problem to do that. Perhaps the British troops may have had the advantage of of education and so on, that they may have been able to save their rations a bit more, but as I say, I think they felt the lack of them even more than the Gurkhas in the end.
And how did you personally cope with the rigors of the march?
Well, I say I was only 19, and in those days I was a very fit 19. And I found I coped extremely well. During the actual expedition itself. In fact, I found that at first, as far as the food was concerned, I used to have I had a little diary with me, notebook, and I used a diary thing, and every day I'd put down what I was going to eat. I'd have two biscuits for lunch and half a packet of dates, perhaps, and I think, and I tried to keep to that. So that I always had something in reserve. But what I felt most of all, and in fact so did the Gurkhas, was the lack of water. Because when we got into the dry zone in the heat, there was very little water. I had to dig for it. And that was really terrible. I mean, different people have different ideas. Some people said they would rather be, if they were hungry, they'd eat anything. But I felt if I was hungry, I wouldn't eat anything at all. But if I was thirsty, I'd drink anything. But I think because I was young, I suppose, and I managed to get through it. And I think probably for this reason, perhaps, at first, Calvert made me the permanent rear guard platoon commander. And so, which was the worst place to march. Because you can imagine, it's a long, 300-odd men and all those mules and horses. It was quite a long snake. And it meant that the people at the back, you'd sometimes stop for 5 minutes, then you had to run like mad to catch up. And it was extremely wearing. And while there were three platoons, of course, in the column, and while the platoons were changed over every few days, poor me, I was permanent rear guard commander and had to do it the whole time. So, as I say, lucky I was pretty fit when I went in, so that I was able to do it.
When did you first run into the Japanese?
It was really quite remarkable that we got as far as the railway line, which I'm sure was the 6th of March. Yes, it was 6th of March, I know, because it was Calvert's 30th birthday. And we crossed on the 15th of February. So from the 15th of February to about the 6th of March, we hadn't seen the Japanese at all. In fact, I think only one group of people actually saw any. So that it's quite remarkable how we were able, in that jungle, to fool them. Of course, they thought we were being... They didn't realize we were being supplied by the air. It wasn't until much later they found that out. So they were looking for our lines of communications, which they weren't any. So, although we didn't meet any Japanese, as I say, until the 6th of March, it was very tough going, because we had to... A lot of the time we were up in these jungle-covered mountains, ranges, etc., finding tracks which had never been used before, and it was with mules and everything else. It was a very tough going. We are fortunate that Mike Calvert, I think, was the one person who Wingate trusted implicitly, and because of that, he was allowed more to go on his own, which is why probably our column did the best a lot in the end, and probably more of us got out eventually. It was because he was allowed to do what he wanted, in a sense, because he was trusted, whereas Wingate kept most of the other columns around him, apart from, of course, one and two column, which I said had been set off on the right as a decoy. So, although we had reports of Japanese and villages and we attacked them, they weren't there. So, anyway, we approached the railway at a place called Nankan, which was the nearest big Burmese village, would be Wan Tho, I suppose, which was roughly between Mandalay and Michinar. And we set up to blow up a couple of bridges and so on. Well, Calvert sent one party with Geoffrey Lockett, who was a commando, British commando, and a lieutenant at the time, and the captain, Silcock, who was a 2IC, George Silcock, who was a second Gurkha, up north of Nankan, if I remember, yes, north, to blow up some bridges there, while Calvert, with myself and a platoon of Gurkhas, plus commandos, went south to blow up some other bridges. In the village, in the Nankan station itself, there was an ambush was laid with Subedar Kumsingurong, who was C Company commander, the senior Gurkha officer. He was told to lay an ambush with a small group of Gurkhas and a Boyd anti-tank rifle. And while the mules and all the rest of it were told to go to a safe place. And there was also a platoon of a party of Burma Rifles under Captain Taffy Griffiths standing by as well in the village. Well, my party, Calvert, went down and we blew up this bridge. And although we hadn't gone very far towards the bridge, when we heard firing in the station, but we carried on, and Calvert and I blew up this bridge. And after we'd blown it up, a Gurkha runner came rushing up to tell him that the Japanese had arrived in the village in lorries and that Kumsingurong had ambushed them. And he had done very well. In fact, one of the lorries was put out of action and several Japanese had been killed. And he was holding up the rest of the Japanese. And Taffy Griffiths had come across with his Burma Rifles to help him. And they were holding up the Japs while we blew up the bridges on either side. So as soon as our bridge was blown, Calvin said, right, we better go off and help them, you see. So we started walking down the railway line towards Nankan. And I was in the front with Calvert. And as we reached the path which we'd used to come down the railway, I looked up to my left and I saw a bearded face looking at me. I was startled. And a whole lot of more bearded faces. And it was a Dane called Erik Peterson from 7 Column with 2 platoons. He'd got split from 7 Column. Didn't know where he was, and so he'd been following our tracks. And he suddenly turned up. So Mike Calvert, of course, never want to lose an opportunity, said, "How would you like chaps like to join us in a little battle?" And they said, "Oh, fine." So we all went off to the railway, where meanwhile, of course, by this time, of course, Kum Singh Gurung and Taffy realized that they were being overwhelmed, and they'd moved out away from the village towards the rendezvous. And then we arrived, caught the Japs napping, and then we had quite a fight with them in the village, and blew up another lorry, and I think an armored car was destroyed. And the Gurkhas and the King's British troops working very well together. And then eventually the Japs withdrew, and by that time it was getting dark, so Calvert decided, right, we better get back to the rendezvous, because a rendezvous had obviously been given beforehand, where everyone had to meet about 6 miles away from the station. we couldn't get to the rendezvous in time, so we camped for the night. And it's a funny thing, I'll never forget that campsite. There was Calvert and I were just the two British officers together, and we were sitting there, and he said, "It's my birthday today," he said, "I'm 30. So I remember saying quite cheekily, "Oh, if I'd known, I'd have bought you a present." "Oh," he said, "who could ask for a better birthday present?" He said, "On whose birthday could you blow up a couple of bridges and kill a whole lot of Japs?" And it was quite remarkable because he built a fire. I must say, one thing about Calvert was that he believed boldness paid off, and he didn't care a damn about the Japs, and if he thought he could have a fire and make tea, he'd have a fire and make tea. And we were never attacked, so we had this fire going. And it seems incredible, looking at it from this distance. There we were. We just had a big battle with the Japs. We were several hundred miles inside the Japanese lines. It looked like a happy camping site. All the Gurkhas were asleep there, quite content and happy, not at all worried, because they they had such faith in Calvert, and they also just had a good defeat of the Japanese. And it was just remarkable, as Calvert and I sat there around the fire having a chat, as though we were in a camping scene. And the Gurkhas were quite... They thought he was such a remarkable person that they felt quite safe. That was our first action, and it's remarkable too that we had not a single casualty, not a single one, not even anyone wounded. And yet we blew up 3 bridges, I think it was, and the railway line in several places, and destroyed several lorries and armored track, and killed quite a number of Japanese soldiers. And later on, when we left a lot of booby traps. And we understood that later on another armored car went in the booby trap and got blown up, and some other lorries. So it was quite a remarkable initiation for the column. And I think that it was also remarkable because we were all strangers to each other, and yet it had worked very well. But I think mainly because of two reasons. One was because Calvert was Calvert, and of course he had... George Silcock, his 2IC, was a very good Gurkhali speaker, and who supported him very closely. He had a good crew.
And in what numbers were the Japanese there at the railway?
Well, it's difficult for me to say this from this time, in fact, because I wouldn't have even known properly at the time, because we were very short of information. But there must have been, in the original lorry convoy, there must have been about 40 or so then, and probably some more arrived later. So I would say perhaps 50 or 60 perhaps, of which about, I don't know what the casualties could have been. You always think you've killed more people than you have, of course. But and reports are very difficult to get. So it wouldn't be very accurate for me to say, but I would think Maybe about 20 or so may have been killed, and perhaps a lot of wounded taken away. We just don't know. But they lost a lot of lorries, and I say at least a couple of armoured lorries. And we had no casualties at all.
And then was it a case of getting back away from the railway as soon as possible?
Well, having blown up the railway, and at the same time, of course, further north of us, Bernard Ferguson had blown up the Bochong, although he'd run into a lot of trouble. He'd blown up the railway, but he'd had several casualties. And further south, the other group, they'd blown up a portion of the railway there. This was a decoy group. But what Wingate didn't realize until a little later on was that number two column, as I told you, in the southern group, there were one column and two column. And they split up to blow up the railway to the south. One column blew up its railway. But two column, when it went to blow up its railway, ran into a very big Japanese ambush. And in the darkness, there was a complete shambles. In the middle of it all, I believe that the column commander changed the rendezvous. So when they dispersed, part of the, I suppose about a quarter of the column went to the original rendezvous, and the rest with the column commander had to go back to India because there was no wireless set, it had gone. There was no way he could operate. But the rest of the column had managed to get the rendezvous and meet up again with number one column, which they joined up with, and with group headquarters under Colonel Alexander. And their object was to go on to cross the Irrawaddy and go up into the Kachin Hills and meet Captain Fish Herring, who was a Kachin speaker, been sent there to see whether the Kachins would be willing to join up with guerrillas and be guerrillas operators. So at the same time, we were approaching the Irrawaddy, and Wingate was now in a situation where, although he'd given instructions to the southern group under Alexander to cross the Irrawaddy, he was in two minds as to whether he should really cross or not. But it was too late because that column had crossed anyway. And Ferguson had almost reached the Irrawaddy, and he said he thought he could get across without any trouble. Because the Irrawaddy was quite a problem to cross when you think of it being nearly a mile wide. And as far as the Gurkha columns were concerned, none of the Gurkhas could swim. And as far as the British columns were concerned, well, quite a few couldn't anyway. So they'd have to get boats. So he said, all right, we'll cross the Irrawaddy. And so five column got across, luckily, with boats and everything else.